Okay. Okay, I believe that we only have 40 minutes, and that is a completely ridiculous amount of time to accomplish what we hope to accomplish in this year. So I'm going to apologize up front that there won't be time for questions. You'll just have to get in touch with me by email. And when we're done, I'm also going to run for a plane when we're done. I want to be open also. So you really have to be. I used to tell my high school students that in order to survive in this class, you need to be at about 110% of intellectual capacity to begin with. And so normally with adults, I'm much more generous and charitable, but 110% minimum if you're going to follow what's going on in this year. Okay, so totally focused. Okay, all psyched? Yeah, there we go. Okay. So we're going to be studying about a prohibition called Lotis Godudu. And we're going to read an extended Talmudic passage, and we're going to realize that the passage makes absolutely no sense. We're going to read some of the desperate attempts to try and institute sense into it. They're going to fail. Then we're going to move into a statement of Maimonides. We're going to realize that is completely incoherent and contradicts itself. We're going to try and resolve that, and it's not going to work either. And then, magically, at the end, we're going to realize that it all made perfect sense. Okay, but unless you understood why it made no sense to begin with, it's going to be very hard to appreciate why it makes sense at the end. Okay, but if you didn't understand it, that was your fault, not mine. Okay, so here we go. So we learned in the Mishnah, this is in Tractate Yibamot, but we learned in the Mishnah that is not in Tractate Yibamot, rather in Masechet Megillah, that Megillat Esther is read on the 11th, the 12th, the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th of Adar, not earlier or later. Okay, so we generally only have the practice of reading the Megillah on the 14th or the 15th, depending on whether you're in Yerushalayim or not. But in the time of the Gemara, you would make sure that in many places you would read the Megillah on the closest market day, which means that you would move Purim, you would move the reading of the Megillah either to the preceding Thursday or to the following Monday. And so it could work out that depending on where you were and on what year, you could read the Megillah on 5 different days in Adar. Okay. Rish Lakish says to Rabbi Yochanan, hang on a sec, isn't this a violation of the biblical prohibition of Lo Tisgodudu? And he says Lo Tisgodudu means Lo Ta'asu Agudot Agudot. Okay, or in very short terms, there can be only one Aguda. Right? An Aguda is a faction. Right? It's a gathering together. And Rish Lakish learns the prohibition of Lo Tisgodudu, which in the simple meaning is that it means you're not allowed to cut yourself excessively in mourning, but that could be done with the word lo togodu, so lo tisgodudu with extra letters. The rabbis say is has an extra meaning, which means that you're not supposed to form into factions. And Reish Lakish says to Rabbi Yochanan, this notion that the Jewish people have to be unified, you cannot form into halachic factions, is violated by having different people reading the Megillah on different places in different days. Everybody should have the standard practice. Rabbi Yochanan says in response to Reish Lakish, how could that be? How can you claim that the law is being violated in this way? We have a Mishnah in Psachim which says, in a place where the custom is to work on Erev Pesach, they work, and where the custom is to not work, they don't work. So he says we have a different Mishnah which says as well that there was a custom at one point that you were not allowed to do work on Erev Pesach. By work, what they mean is the kind of work that you are not allowed to do on Chol HaMoed, right? Work unrelated to the preparation for the Yom Tov, or which does not involve immediate financial loss. And the Mishnah says that there were places where the custom was this way, and there were places where the custom was that way, and each place should follow its own minhag. So Rabbi Yochanan says, "What, Reish Lakish, like, what are you talking about? How can you claim that there's a violation of Lo Tisgodudu? Nobody believes that you have to standardize practice across all of Israel." To which Reish Lakish says to Rabbi Yochanan, "I was speaking about law, and you were speaking to me of custom. They're different cases entirely. It's fine to say that when we have law, that when people have practices that they explicitly ground as laity-driven groundswell, right? They're not law. They're just things that we do. So that doesn't violate Lo Tisgodudu because it doesn't implicate Torah. Right? We understand it could be this way. It could be that way. That's okay. But Reish Lakish says, I don't understand how we could possibly have the law tell people to do one thing in one place and one place and one thing in a different place. That's a violation of Lotus Go to do if the law tells people to do different things. Okay, the Gemara then gets into a whole discussion about how we played it out, and it ends up saying that, you know, that case in Psachim, which we just talked about, that's really a dispute between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. It's not just a question of custom. So that's also law. So now what do we do? Right? Can we really have circumstances in which the law tells some people to do this and some people to tell that? Or is that a violation of Lotus Go to do? So this, at this point, the Gemara segues into a discussion. Well, you know what? If you're going to tell me that it's a violation of Lotus Go to do, in that case about doing work on Erev Pesach, and that case turns into a dispute between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, then every single case where Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai dispute, they are each in violation of biblical law. Every dispute between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai is a violation of the biblical law against Lotus Go to do. How can that be? So the Gemara comes up for Reish Lakish, right? So the Gemara says Reish Lakish could not conceivably have claimed that Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai were in violation of Lotus Go to do in every single case. Inconceivable. So what must Reish Lakish have said? The Gemara comes up with a fantastic assumption for Reish Lakish. Beit Shammai's positions were purely theoretical. They never actually acted on their own positions. All the disputes we have into Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai are purely theoretical. Everybody always acted like Beit Hillel. And Beit Shammai just said, you know what? But that shouldn't be. But they always lost. Except one day, which the Gemara here doesn't mention, because they always lost because they were a minority, right? But there's one day the Yerushalmi tells you where Beit Shammai got sick of it, and so they ambushed the students of Beit Hillel on the way to the Beit Midrash and didn't, right, and physically prevented them from entering, and then they had a vote. And Beit Shammai won on that day, and that's where we have many of the rabbinic legislations that require separation from Gentiles, because Beit Shammai got a majority that day. And that's a really interesting question as to why that worked out. And the Babylonian Talmud has this fascinating claim that those laws can never be overturned because Beit Shammai risked their lives to implement them because they got into a big fight because they ambushed Beit Hillel. But we're going to bracket that conversation for today. It's just a lot of fun. Okay. So the Gemara says, so Reish Lakish, who says that even different, even when both of you are acting in accordance with the law, you're in violation of the law if you do different things. So he believes that Beit Shammai never practiced what they preached. And Rabbi Yochanan says, no, Beit Hillel practiced what they preached, so it must not be a violation. And the Gemara says, this recapitulates the argument. It turns out that this argument was not just Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish in Eretz Yisrael. It was also a dispute between Rav and Shmuel in Bavel about whether the way in which we understand the dispute between Hillel and Beit Shammai is a purely theoretical controversy, but everyone always agreed that you had to follow Beit Hillel in practice, or whether it was in fact a practical dispute in which Beit Shammai, some people followed Beit Shammai in practice and some people did not. So now the Gemara says, hang on a sec, when? When is this argument going on? Because we know that there is a historical period at which the halakha becomes like Beit Hillel. Anybody know, right, why does halakha follow Beit Hillel? Because a heavenly voice comes out, right? When? If it's before the heavenly voice, the bat kol, which said, famously, Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim v'halacha ki divrei Beit Hillel. You have to be very cautious. It used to be my job. I'm a Wexner graduate fellow, and it's a pluralistic Orthodox, non-Orthodox thing together. So it used to be my role. There would always be somebody get up and say, Elu ve'elu, right? Why is there this controversy between Orthodoxy and other denominations? Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim. So all multiple words of God. And my job was to get up and say, v'halacha ki divrei Beit Hillel. Right? All these positions are fine in theory, but the practice, right? The Bat Kol says, but the practice and the purpose of the heavenly voice is to tell you that even though multiple interpretations of Torah are possible and legitimate, sometimes you have to decide the law. But now the Gemara says, when are you claiming that there is this dispute as to whether or not Beit Shammai acted on their own position? If it's before the heavenly voice, then why would anyone care I think I have it backwards here. If it's before the heavenly voice, why would anyone think they shouldn't? I have it backwards in the English translation. I apologize. There's no heavenly voice, right? That's what happens. You have an argument. You follow your own position. Why would Beit Shammai have conceded to Beit Hillel before God told them they were wrong? On the other hand, if it's after the heavenly voice, what possible grounds could Beit Shammai have for following their own position? So that one's easy. You all know the answer to that one. What's the answer? No. What's the answer? No. Lo b'shamayim hi. Right? We all know, right? Torah is not in heaven. Who cares about a heavenly voice? We'll have to get back to that, right? Why? Since we all know, Rabbi Yeshua says elsewhere that the Torah is not in heaven. We don't listen to heavenly voices. So why is it that in fact we have decided, right? Everyone loves quoting Lo b'shamayim hi, and we support the excommunication of Rabbi Eliezer in the story of the Oven Shalachnai, and we don't follow the Torah is on earth and not in heaven, and we all follow Beit Hillel, even though they're both based on heavenly voices. That's a problem we'll have to live with. But everyone understands how Beit Shammai could not have followed Beit Hillel. They could have rejected the authority of the heavenly voice. But what about the other way? So Gemara says we can explain it either before or after. And the explanation of how Beit Shammai did it before, and nonetheless we might say that before there could be a dispute as to whether Beit Shammai followed their own practice, is fascinating. Everyone agrees that there are more rabbis belonging to Beit Hillel than there are in Beit Shammai. Everyone agrees. Beit Shammai never had the majority. So therefore, Beit Hillel always believed that the halakha followed them. And you all know the halakha does follow them, right? Because it's Acharei Rabbim L'Hatot. Right? The law follows the majority. So how could you possibly say that Beit Shammai was entitled to follow their own opinion? Who gets the vote? Beit Shammai had the majority of really, really smart people. and so when they had votes, the majority followed Beit Hillel and said, you follow the majority. But the majority of smart people followed Beit Shammai. And then they had a vote about whether you follow the majority of people, the majority of really smart people. And the majority of people said, you follow the majority of people. And the majority of smart people said, no, you follow the majority of smart people. They had this, right, this could go on forever. Right, so, right, the way in which Beit Shammai could not follow their own opinion is if they agreed that you have to follow pure democracy. Although even that's probably not pure democracy. It's probably a debate about whether you let graduates of particular rabbinic institutions into the RCA or something. And Beit Hillel said, right, Beit Shammai said otherwise. Okay. Now we've understood what the dispute between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai is. But now the Gemara says, let's go back to our original question. So now we understand that Beit Shammai, there is a position, both before and after the heavenly voice, let's focus on before, which says that Beit Shammai held their position, and Beit Hillel held their position, and Beit Shammai followed their position, and Beit Hillel followed their position. Hang on a sec, we just said that's illegal. Isn't that a violation of Lo Tiskodetu? How can that be? So Abaye says, we only apply Lo Tiskodetu to, for example, two courts in the same city, of whom one rules like Beit Shammai and the other like Beit Hillel, but two courts in different cities cannot run afoul of this prohibition. Okay, so now Abaye sort of pulls the teeth of this, and he says, it's okay to have different practices as long as the two practices don't meet. Right, we can have in Toronto, they can do Malacha on Erev Pesach, and in Sharon, Massachusetts, they cannot, and that's fine. But he says, if there were a Haredi Beit Din in Toronto and a Modern Orthodox Beit Din in Toronto, and one of them said you can do Malacha on Erev Pesach, and one of them said you can't, that would be a violation of Lo Tiskodetu. Okay, that's not an unreasonable position. Rava says it's not an unreasonable position, but it completely fails to answer the question, because Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai lived in the same city. So if the whole purpose of your answer was to try and explain how Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai could follow different positions without violating Lo Tiskodetu, you have completely failed to explain that. So Rava says, no, I have a better answer. The better answer is that Lo Tiskodetu is violated. We only apply Lo Tiskodetu, for example, a single court in a single city, of whom part rule like Beit Shammai and part rule like Beit Hillel. But as long as they're not on the same court, everything is great. And that is the end of the sugya. The end of the sugya is that we rule that lo tizgodudu is not violated as long as you have separate courts, but is violated when you are on the same court. Which I hope, now you've had it like 10 seconds to absorb, it is ridiculous. Totally ridiculous. Why do we have three members on a court? Yes?
So you have a forced mechanism of decision.
Exactly right. So you have a forced mechanism of decision, which means that the assumption is that you will disagree. And you'll have a majority. So, but according to Rava now, that is exactly what the prohibition is, to have court members disagree. The whole mechanism of the court is set up to enable, right, as a decision procedure for disagreements. And now you're telling me that the existence of disagreement is per se a violation. That's absurd. We went through this whole long sugya, and we end up with a complete absurdity. Okay, now obviously that can't be.
Was it a rule like that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Close.
Ruling
means
they think. Part of them think like Beit Shammai, part of them think like Beit Hillel, but the ruling for the city is majority.
So, but that shouldn't be a violation of what it's going to do. That should be a violation of the whole mechanism. What's the purpose of a court decision if it's not binding on the minority? Right, that doesn't... That, that. Right, that... Okay, the Netziv... Yeah. Good.
It's different panels. So that you could conceivably have two different panels
on the same Beit Din. Ah, each. That's very clever. Gemara doesn't think of that. That's very clever.
It's not clever. It's just,
okay, good. So let's hold that. It's very clever. we can define what does it mean to be on the same Beit Din. Right? Very clever. I don't think we usually think of that as the same. You know, the notion of an administrative structure which produces multiple panels that are still there, I think that's anachronistic. But it's very clever. You should write it.
But that's what
yes, I know, but I don't think it's what... I think that using it... Right. Okay. So the Netziv comes up with an amazing line. He says, one court means everyone agrees that the law follows a particular position, but nonetheless, some judges rule in accordance with Beit Shammai as a matter of practice, and some judges institute practice in accordance with the position of Beit Hillel. So the Netziv says the violation is... Really, the only case is where everyone agrees the halakha is one way, which is mekil, which is lenient. But some judges say, nonetheless, you should follow the stringent position of Beit Shammai. When they impose that stringent position as a matter of practice, acknowledging that it's not law, that's a violation of lo tizgodudu. Okay, that's very, very clever, but implausible, I think, in the text. I want to just hold that question, because to me this is and not just to me, to basically all the achronim, this is just a source of great mystery. How could you possibly claim that it's a violation of lo tizgodudu to have a dispute on a court, when the whole nature of a court is to have a dispute? We're going to hold off on that and move on to something that picks up on what we said before. Okay, so we saw before, and now we're in source 3, in a place where the practice is to do work on Erev Pesach until noon, they do so. In a place where the practice is not to, they don't. What do you do if you move? All right, so in Sharon, Massachusetts, we do not work on Erev Pesach. In Toronto, you do. And I come from Sharon, Massachusetts to Toronto on Erev Pesach, or vice versa. So here's what the Mishnah says. Right, if you go from a place where they work on Erev Pesach to a place where they don't, or vice versa, we place upon you the stringencies of the place you came from and the stringencies of the place you went to. Right? So you always have to follow the more stringent position. Okay, that's pretty clear. But then it has this fascinating line. It says, "Ve'al yishane adam mipnei ha-machloket." A person should not behave differently. I shouldn't even have translated it. A person should not behave differently mipnei ha-machloket. Behave differently than what or whom? So this is a bit of a challenge, because it can mean two different things. It can mean a person should not behave differently than the place where he is currently. Because if he behaves differently than the place where he is currently, he will cause controversy. Or it can mean a person should not behave differently than he did in the place where he came from, just because of controversy. So the Mishnah is beautifully ambiguous. We don't know which one it means, and in fact, which one it is turns into a machloka between Abaye and Rava, in which one of them says that it means that that no matter what, you always adopt the stringent position, and one of them says you adopt the stringent position unless that will cause controversy with the people around you, because they'll look at you and say, ha, he is being holier than thou. Okay, and the class, right, so they say that if they'll catch you, right, if you stop doing something and they say, why are you not doing this? And you'll say, well, because I think it's asur, then they'll look at you and say, you're a firmak. That violates the prohibition against lotus go to do. I happen to have a personal story about this, which relates to the important halakhic thing about whether you keep the second day Yom Tov in Eretz Yisrael as an American or not. And so the ruling that says you keep the second day is grounded in the claim that the Talmud says nobody will notice if you're keeping the second day Yom Tov, because after all, right, they'll just say, look how many lazy people there are today. So on the second day Yom Tov in Israel, I'm there at my in-laws' house. My in-laws were there for the year, and the Federal Express person shows up. And he says, I have a package for you. Can you sign? And I'm saying, I'm sorry, it's Yom Tov. And he says, what? Yom Tov? Yom Tov was yesterday. I say, no. It's Yom Tov for me. Ridiculous. And he calls the district manager, the district manager calls the state manager, and this entire calls up the whole chain of the Federal Express store to see if I can sign or not. And the whole time I'm just thinking of this Gemara, which says, oh, there's no problem being more machmir. Because everybody will just say, oh, look how many lazy people there are in the day today. Which was why I realized that the whole thing is a mistake, because what the Gemara is talking about is not Yom Tov. The Gemara is talking about the day before Yom Tov, when you are allowed to do things that will otherwise cause loss. Right? So those kinds of, the equivalent of Melechet Chol HaMoed. So Melechet Chol HaMoed, you can say that if you take the more stringent position, it won't be noticeable and it won't cause controversy. Nobody ever suggested that was true about actually keeping Yom Tov. That, I think, is an error. And the halakha about the second day Yom Tov is grounded, unfortunately, in that error often. Okay, in any case, you can read my article about this if you so wish. What we end up with is is this peculiar language. We have this line, "Va'al yishane adam mipnei hamachloket," that might mean that you're not allowed to change your behavior because changing your behavior will cause controversy, and causing controversy is bad. Or it might mean you're not allowed to change your behavior just because it's going to cause controversy, because you have to do the right thing. Why should you care about controversy? Okay, so now here is the issue. How does this relate to the prohibition of lotus gotiju? So Maimonides, we're in source 5 now. Maimonides says, within the scope of this prohibition, i.e. the prohibition of lotus gotiju, is that there should not be two courts in a single city which adopt different practices, as this causes great disputes, and the Torah says lotus gotiju, meaning do not form factions. So Maimonides says, the prohibition of lotus gotiju means do not cause controversy. Right? So Maimonides understands the prohibition that way, that the reason that you cannot do things, that you cannot engage in different practices at certain occasions, is because we were afraid that it will cause controversy. Perfectly reasonable position. Now we're going to take a look at a different position of Maimonides. So here is Maimonides' history of the Jewish world. It doesn't agree quite with Rabbi Krauss's, with Rabbi Villick's position, you'll see. This is Maimonides' history of Dayanut. So here's this. When the great court existed, the Sanhedrin HaGadol, there were no disputes in Israel. Rather, any law regarding which a Jew developed an uncertainty, he would ask the court in his city about it. If they knew, they would tell him. If they didn't know, they would all come to the court in the Temple Mount. And basically, there is an entire hierarchical system. But the end of it is, everyone, at the end of the day, there is a decision procedure. And that decision procedure is the high court. As long as there is a high court, there can never be controversies in Israel about what to do, because we just go up to the high court, whatever they say goes. Okay? Until... here we go. When the great court ceased, right, when the Sanhedrin HaGadol ceased to be a central authority, when we finally disestablished the Rabbanut, dispute multiplied in Israel. This one would declare something impure and provide a rationale, and this one would declare it pure and provide a rationale. This one would forbid, and this one would permit. Okay? So Maimonides has this vision of Jewish history, in this vision of Jewish history. So remember, he said it's a prohibition of lotus go to do whenever there's a dispute about what to do. Right? You don't want to cause controversy. And therefore, in accordance with this system, he constructs a halachic history. In his halachic history, there was a time when there was no dispute about what to do. As long as it was Sanhedrin HaGadol, we lived in this paradise where there were no controversies in Israel. And it was the loss of centralized authority which led to the breakdown of that and led to our current situation, which we can see as an ongoing violation of Lotus Gododu, because here we are factionalized left and right. But you have to compare Maimonides to his source and realize what he's doing here. So if you turn to source number 7, in source number 7, towards the bottom, in the English translation, I have the section cut off. Here's the brayta that Maimonides is citing. Said Rabbi Yossi, originally disputes in Israel did not multiply. Okay, and we go line by line, exactly as Maimonides says, through the same procedure, but then look at the underlying section. After the multiplication of the students of Hillel and Shammai, who had not served their teachers to the extent needed for their own development, disputes multiplied in Israel, and the Torah became as two Torahs. Students of Hillel and Shammai. Now, this is certainly historically correct, because we know for sure, that when there were students of Hillel and Shammai, there were controversies left and right. But here's the problem. The houses of Hillel and Shammai exist while the Sanhedrin still exists. So Maimonides' historical presentation is incorrect. It's not true that there were no disputes in Israel while there was a great Sanhedrin, unless you take the position that Beit Shammai did not follow their own, did not practice their own positions. But if you work on the assumption that Beit Shammai did follow their own positions, then disputes existed before the Sanhedrin broke down. Now, the only thing is, there's a reason Maimonides cuts this line out. Because actually, it seems completely out of place here. Right? The rest of the Braita is following the same. It begins, there were no disputes in Israel because there was a Sanhedrin. And in fact, if you look at source 8, you'll see that this line about the multiplication of the students of Israel was probably not originally part of this Braita. The Braita originally looked something like Maimonides, but there was a different Mishnah in Sota, which says, after the multiplication of the intellectually arrogant people, disputes multiplied in Israel. After the multiplication of the students of Shammai and Hillel, who would not serve their teachers to the extent they needed for their own development, Shimshu called Tzarchan, disputes multiplied in Israel, and somebody noticed that, hang on a sec, these two things don't cohere. You cannot claim that the existence of the Sanhedrin prevented controversy, and that the students of Hillel and Shammai were the cause of the multiplication of disputes, because the multiplication of the students of Hillel and Shammai happened while there was still a great Sanhedrin. So now we have to figure out, how could there be a dispute? How could there be disputes among the students of Hillel and Shammai? The Gemara asks, what about the heavenly voice? But you don't need a heavenly voice to prevent the controversy and to prevent Beit Shammai from acting in accordance with their own position. All you need to do is to say there is the authority of the great Sanhedrin. Have a vote. Whoever wins, wins. And you can't tell me that members of the Sanhedrin don't get to vote because they're not smart enough. They're members of the Sanhedrin. So what would be Beit Shammai's excuse for acting in accordance with their own behavior, with their own positions, if they were outvoted during the time that the Sanhedrin existed? Okay, so now we have two things we have to solve. One thing is, how could the Gemara come up with this wild idea that it's a violation of lo tisgo to have a court which include members who disagree? And how can it be that if there is a system designed to prevent disputes, namely the Great Sanhedrin, and there is a mechanism for resolving all disputes, which is have the Great Sanhedrin vote, how could it be that the disputes between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai multiplied while there was a Great Sanhedrin? Okay. So if you take a look at Tosfot tries to figure out how we can resolve the issue about the two heavenly voices, right? Why do we follow the heavenly voice in one place and not follow the heavenly voice in the other way? And Tosfot says, I have two possibilities. One possibility is that the heavenly voice in the case of Rabbi Eliezer and the Oven of Achnai, the reason we don't follow it is because it wasn't a true heavenly voice. Right? God just sent it because he wanted to make Rabbi Eliezer feel good. And we figured that out. Okay, that's based off another Gemara in Brachot, where God sends Rabbi Gamliel a dream, and then the Talmud says, oh, by the way, God just sent it, it wasn't true, it just sent it to make it feel better. So sometimes God lies to us, and we have to take it right, and hopefully because he wants to make someone feel better, right? Because we know that God, right, God lies to Sarah, right, God lies to Avram about what Sarah said, right? Sarah said that Avram is old, and God says to Avram that Sarah said she was old because God believes in Shalom Bayit. So God likes to make rabbis feel good also, and the job of the rest of us is to realize when God's just saying a polite social fiction and not really telling us the law. That's Tosfos' first answer. Very cute. Scary. The second answer, Tosfos says, is wilder. Tosfos says, alternatively, we say that in that case, the case of Rabbi Eliezer, the heavenly voice opposed the majority. But in this case, the heavenly voice supported the majority. What? Who needs the heavenly voice? We have the majority. Right, so that answer is really, really difficult to make any sense of at all. So far we haven't made any progress at all. Okay, let's take a look at Rashi in Yevamot. So Rashi says, and this you have to read very, very closely. Rashi says, do not form factions. Now here, actually, no, before we read Rashi, let's go back and take a look at source number. We'll see that Maimonides, when he gave the history of Halakha, he left out another thing. He said, when the Sanhedrin broke down, disputes multiplied. But let's watch. Look what sources 7 and 8 say. After the multiplication, the students at Hillel and Shammai would not serve their teachers to the extent needed for their own development. Disputes multiplied in Israel, and the Torah became as two Torahs. Maimonides left that out. Now, the question is, disputes multiplied in Israel and the Torah became as two Torahs. Is that just explaining disputes multiplied and the Torah became as two Torahs, or is it a completely different factor? So if you take a look at Rashi on the Sugya Yevamot, Rashi says, and the key one is the Rashi says in that case, Rashi says, in that case, everyone agrees it's permissible, but nonetheless, in a place where they are stringent, one should not behave differently, lest there be disputes. Now, what he means by that, Rashi says, is there are cases where it's permissible. Permissible in terms of what? It's not a violation of Lotus Godudu. Why? It's not a violation of Lotus Godudu because it does not look like two Torahs. And even though it doesn't look like two Torahs, and therefore it's not a violation of Lotus Godudu, you still can't do it because it causes controversy. So according to Rashi, the prohibition of Lotus Godudu is unrelated to the prohibition against causing controversy. Right? In fact, Rashi says that Lotus Godudu is violated when you don't have controversies. Because when does the Torah appear as two Torahs? The Torah appears as two Torahs not when we're fighting, because when we're fighting, we agree there's one Torah and we're fighting about what it means. But when we say, I'm okay, you're okay, then there are two Torahs. We no longer fight. That's when you violate Lotus Godudu, according to Rashi. Right? So it's a fundamental dispute between Maimonides and the Rambam, Maimonides and Rashi. Maimonides says that Lotus Godudu is violated when you fight. Rashi says Lotus Godudu is violated when you don't fight. Okay, now, I have to go back and use this, and I'm going to try and solve our initial problems. So if you look at Nachmanides, Tuchulin, and Rabbi Nissim. We're not going to have time to read it inside because I have a note here telling me that my time is running out. You'll see Nachmanides tries to figure out what's going on in the controversy between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, and he has a fascinating line. We'll actually look at this line inside. He says, I can respond. Right, so Nachmanides has a different problem. He says, I have yet another decision procedure. So we had a heavenly voice. We had a vote in Sanhedrin. Nachmanides says, I have a different procedure, which probably many of you know, which is that when you have biblical laws, if there's a dispute about biblical law, you follow the stringent position. When there's a dispute about rabbinic law, you follow the lenient position. So again, why should Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel ever fight? If they're arguing about a biblical matter, then the stringent position wins. If they're arguing about a rabbinic matter, the lenient position wins. So Nachmanides answers. He says, I can respond that because the dispute between the students of the house of Shammai and the students of Hillel was large, and all the sages of Israel were subsumed within it, and the Torah became for them as two Torahs. Watch, he's quoting sources 7 and 8. Everyone has the right to follow either. Now, how does that follow? So here's the fundamental thesis. Nachmanides says that there is a violation of lotus godedu when you have a point at which nobody is capable of having deliberation. When people make their decisions on the basis of ideological commitments. Because when I decide an issue because I belong to Beit Shammai, and you decide a position because you belong to Beit Hillel, then we are no longer capable of having a real conversation. Our premises are different. Our political commitments are different. Nothing you can say to me will change my mind. Nothing I can say to you will change your mind. Conversation has broken down. In such a case, says Nachmanides, there is a violation of lotus godedu, but I can't tell you that you have to give in. You'll tell me that I have to give in. And there's no longer space for conversations. So Nachmanides says is that the rules about following the stringent and the lenient position didn't apply to the dispute between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, because there was nobody outside the realm of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai who thought that there was a controversy. All the people in Beit Shammai knew which way the halakha was. All the people in Beit Hillel knew which way the halakha was. There was no conversation. There was no decision. When you have ideological controversy, when arguments are no longer relevant, then majority rule is irrelevant. Because the majority rule is only a decision procedure when you, as the result of deliberation. Right? Then it matters, because right, we've thought about it objectively, we each reach a decision. But when majority rule is just a function of which school has more students, then it's not Torah discussion, it's just politics. And we'll say, oh, you know what? I'll give more guys smicha so I can win. No. Right? I'll give more spread. We'll just have giant things trying to deputize as many people as we can, so we can win the vote. That's not how halakhic controversy is supposed to have. It's supposed to be serious dispute about the meaning, right? The meaning of the law and what the law ought to be. So Nachmanides says that at such a point as you have ideological disputes, majority and minority are irrelevant. And therefore, you cannot have a court, a single court, in which some members belong to Beit Hillel and some members belong to Beit Shammai, because the purpose of a court is to engage in deliberation. And if the court's decisions are just going to divide between along liberal and conservative lines, and no one is any longer interested in the arguments of the other side, then the court loses its legitimacy. So the Sanhedrin stopped being able to decide decisions in the time of the students of Hillel and Shammai, because on any issue that was a dispute between the students of Hillel and Shammai, they would not allow the Sanhedrin to make a decision, because that was just politics. Which of our schools gets more seats on the Sanhedrin? It had no legitimacy whatsoever. So according to Rashi, the definition of lotus godedu is the opposite of controversy. Lotus godedu happens and is violated when two segments of the halakhic community no longer seek to convince the other to follow their position. When they are no longer open to being convinced by the other side. Now, here's the thing. Okay, let's suppose I am ideologically Haredi. So I believe it is absolutely prohibited to read the poetry of John Milton. Okay, but Barry goes to Yeshivat Har Etzion, in which Rav Aaron Lichtenstein believes that it's imperative to read the poetry of John Milton. Okay, so now we are not really capable of engaging in controversy, because for Barry to convince me, he would have to read me the poetry of John Milton, which I believe is prohibited for me to read. So it's not possible he's going to convince me. And I'm going to have to convince him that it's religiously meaningless, but he knows otherwise because he's experienced it. So we are not going to agree about the practice of the community about the reading of Paradise Lost. So lotus godedu is being violated. By whom? By which of us? Lotus godedu is a prohibition that is never useful in post facto. You can never tell anyone that they can't do what they're doing because you're violating lotus godedu, because they'll say, no, you're the one who's violating lotus godedu because you should agree with me. Okay, and now we'll get to the thesis of the shir, halachic rights of ideological minorities. So, when you have an ideological minority within halacha, right, so unlike non-ideological minorities, can be overruled by majorities when they seek to impose their will, because you're engaged in a deliberative process and majority rule wins. But when the dispute is ideological, then majority rule becomes irrelevant, and ideological minorities have the right to maintain their halachic positions. However, majorities have the right to claim that you are not an ideological minority. What you are is outside the camp. Right? You are not, right? You're not a minority. What you are is a revolutionary party. So the challenge is, as a community, is to try and figure out, on the one hand, how you maintain, if you are a minority, how you maintain your independence and say, no, the fact that there are more of you than us does not bind us to you because you are not listening to our arguments. And at the same time, when you have power as a majority, to figure out which minorities you're willing to say, you know what, I think you're wrong, but I don't have the power to compel you because communication has broken down. But even though communication has broken down, you are still part of the halachic community, and so I don't seek to impose my will on you. Right? And this fundamentally is, you know, right now we could say sociologically, this is generally understood as the difference between groups subgroups within Orthodoxy, and the boundary between Orthodoxy and non-Orthodoxy. Right, on the boundary between Orthodoxy and non-Orthodoxy, Orthodoxy generally rules that, right, you are an illegitimate minority. But within Orthodoxy, we're perfectly happy to let Hasidim do their own thing, and to let Sephardim and Ashkenazim do their own thing, even though each of these are violations of Lotus Go to do. Can't have more than two Torahs than Sephardim doing their thing and Ashkenazim doing their thing. Just we decided a long time ago that dispute, because it involved community identity, was no longer subject to majority vote. So the questions going on right now that are critical is that modern Orthodoxy wishes to sustain its identity as a, right now we have to be honest, right, we are a ideological minority within the halachic community. And so our goal is to not allow ourselves to be outvoted by the Haredi community. And at the same time, we have our own issues. Within modern Orthodoxy, there are splits, and people want to say, well, you know, that's no longer a thing. And it's very hard to figure out what the boundaries should be. I'll just say one last thing. There are two reasons we rule like Beit Hillel. One reason we rule like Beit Hillel is because there's a heavenly voice. The other reason we rule like Beit Hillel is because they still quoted Beit Shammai. Meaning that Beit Hillel still saw it, even though they knew that they were no longer open to being persuaded by Beit Shammai. They still thought it at least a value to quote Beit Shammai's positions. Beit Shammai, right, so Beit Hillel at least tried to prevent the prohibition of Lotus Gododu, even they were unable to. Beit Shammai just said, you don't count. Right, so Halacha ultimately followed the position which believed there was a value in continuing the conversation and sought at least to formally maintain the dialogue, even when it was clear that it was no longer capable of real communication. And that, I think, is a lesson that we need to learn as we try and construct our community, that we should do our best without saying that I give in to your majority, to nonetheless try and maintain the possibility of genuine halachic conversation. All right, thank you very much for listening.